Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program with me, Isaac Mgabi, your host.
And I'm Wanjiko Mwaura from the social media desk, and I'll be keeping you up to date with what's trending on our social radio, so don't miss out on that.
That's right. Coming up on the program, opposition politicians in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, agree in principle to a deal under which President Joseph Kabila leaves office by the end of 2017.
This deal is a very important one. It's one that's been followed through by the church. The Catholic Church has really put a lot of pressure, and they've made sure that all the relevant partners to be involved.
Leaders from Central Africa meet in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, to discuss economic and security issues in the region.
Notre sous-région ne saurait être là.
Our sub-region will not be in an impasse if we remain united and if we transform our political will to adopt appropriate economic measures.
These are just some of the stories that we've lined up for you in the next half hour. But first, let's listen to what is taking place around the world.
I'm Mark Caldwell with the DW News. The Tunisian man suspected of ploughing a truck through a crowded Berlin Christmas market has been shot dead by Italian police on the northern outskirts of Milan. Anis Anri was killed in a shootout after police stopped him during a routine patrol in the early hours of this morning. On Friday afternoon, German Chancellor Angela Merkel thanked the Italian authorities for what she described as close cooperation in the case. She also said she had spoken to the president of Tunisia, Besci Kaid Essebsi.
I told the president we want the deportation of failed Tunisian asylum seekers to be speeded up in future and the number of deported to be increased as well.
Hijackers diverted a Libyan plane carrying 118 people to the Mediterranean island of Malta on Friday and threatened to blow it up with hand grenades. After tense negotiations, 109 passengers were allowed to leave the plane. Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat said the hijackers have surrendered in the meantime and have been taken into custody. The crew are safe. President-elect Donald Trump has reopened the debate over nuclear proliferation, calling for the United States to greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until the rest of the world comes to its senses regarding nuclear weapons. At a news conference on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he hoped to have a meeting with Donald Trump to discuss how to improve bilateral ties. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. United Nations agencies have said that around 100 people are missing and feared dead after two shipwrecks off the coast of Italy on Thursday. The Italian Coast Guard carried out a total of 4 rescue operations in the central Mediterranean on that day. Deaths linked to Mediterranean crossings by migrants have increased sharply this year. William Spindler is a spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency.
An average of 14 people have died every day in the Mediterranean Sea during 2016, the highest number ever recorded.
West Africa's regional bloc ECOWAS has put standby forces on alert in case Gambian President Yahya Jammeh does not step down when his mandate ends on January the 19th. Jammeh has vowed to stay in power despite losing an election to his rival Adamo Barrow earlier this month. This has raised the possibility of regional powers intervening if diplomacy does not succeed in persuading him to leave. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has joined a summit of Central African leaders in Cameroon aimed at tackling economic woes brought on by weak oil prices. Opening the summit, Cameroonian President Paul Biya said, "Our foreign exchange reserves have dropped substantially. We need to act fast. We need to act together." The presence of the head of the IMF at the meeting had not been announced previously. For more news and information, please visit our website dw.com. I'm Mark Caldwell.
And you're listening to Africa Link from DW in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Wanjiko Mwaura.
We begin today's program in the DRC, where opposition politicians have agreed in principle to a deal under which President Joseph Kabila leaves office by the end of 2017, an unexpected breakthrough after dozens were killed in anti-government protests this week. Kabila's mandate expired on Tuesday this week, but he has remained in office as a presidential election scheduled for last month was postponed until at least April 2018 because of what the government said were delays registering voters. Before we came on air, I spoke to Ayo Johnson, the director of Viewpoint Africa in London, and I started by asking him whether the deal will enable a smooth transition of power.
Is a very important one. It's one that's been followed through by the church. The Catholic Church has really put a lot of pressure. They've coordinated these meetings and they've made sure that all the relevant partners, Mr. Kabila, his own parties, and of course Mr. Tshisekedi, the opposition party, to be involved, including some other smaller groups. And ultimately, it comes down to this, that Kabila could stay in power till at least the end of 2017. Ultimately, there would be general elections. He wouldn't take part in those elections. The opposition would at least stand a chance to change the course of Congolese history.
Now that all parties have agreed in principle, as we mentioned before, to allow Kabila remain in office until 2017, will the country be ready for the elections given its vastness?
Well, one of the reasons why we got to the position where we are now is because the Electoral Commission wasn't ready. The ballots were not ready. Those who had to be registered to take part in these elections were not registered. The numbers were not sufficient. And so it remains to be seen whether the process is robust enough for the electoral processes to be worked out in time for 2018. Again, we've seen already where they failed previously to achieve that target, and we're hoping this time that the target has already been set based on these agreements, that the Electoral Commission at least meets its own part of the bargain and ensures that elections take place and they run free and fair for the entire world to see.
Now let's talk about veteran opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi, the leader of the largest opposition party, that is the UDPS, or the Union for Democracy and Social Progress. He has been fighting governments since the time of Mobutu and the two Kabilas. Do you think this is his time to take over the mantle and lead the country to progress?
Well, many would say that he's too old. He's a veteran politician, but he is the only hope that the Congo has right now. We must remember that, as you just said, back in Mobutu's days, in 1997, as far back as then, he was running the show. And if it wasn't for the fact that Kabila's father, who himself took over the country, and of course Kabila himself in 2001 because of the death of his father, and subsequent elections 2006 and 2011, change. People were asking for real change, for a proper handover from military to civilian, from civilian to civilian. That is what people have been talking about. They want continuity of governance. And of course this election, 2018, provides that opportunity.
Aya Johnson from Viewpoint, based in London. President-elect Donald Trump has called for an expansion of the nuclear capabilities of the United States. His tweet has alarmed people working for the reduction of stockpiles of nuclear arms and recalls the tensions that surrounded these weapon systems during the Cold War. In Russia, meanwhile, President Vladimir Putin has been holding his end-of-year press conference. DW's Nicholas Connolly in Moscow has been following developments and asked him how Putin responded to Trump's tweet about the U.S. nuclear arsenal.
He began by expressing his regret that the U.S. had withdrawn from the anti-ballistic missile treaty in the early 2000s under George W. Bush. And he really said that was the spark, the beginning, that had sent the U.S. and Russia into renewing their nuclear arsenals. He said that Russia was upgrading its navy, its air force, and its rocket capacities, and that they could now effectively combat any missile defense systems that the U.S. comes up with. But he was clear to stress that the U.S. isn't, they don't see the U.S. as an aggressor or a direct competitor in that sense, but he was clear they needed to maintain a parity of nuclear capacity. He drew attention to the fact that the U.S. was replacing its strategic nuclear weapons in Turkey, in the U.K., in the Netherlands. But on the other hand, he said he wouldn't allow Russia to be drawn into an expensive arms race, one that it might not be able to afford.
And what did Putin have to say about Syria? And how closely is Russia going to work with the West in resolving this conflict?
Again, rather vague sort of general answers from Putin on this. There were no concrete plans for cooperation with the West. Instead, he called for a ceasefire now that Aleppo has been retaken by the Assad government. He said there needed to be a ceasefire followed by peace talks in a neutral place. He suggested the Kazakhstan capital Astana for that. And what he really stressed was the importance of working together with Turkey and Iran. That's the sort of, you know, three format, the Troika format that we saw meet in Moscow a few days ago. And he invited other players such as the US or Saudi Arabia to join in their efforts. But the real focus of Russian policy will be on working with Turkey and Iran and obviously the Assad regime in Damascus.
What about the allegations that Russia meddled in the US elections?
Well, he didn't deny that there was Russian hacking. The BBC's correspondent asked directly about it. Instead, he said all these allegations about Russian involvement coming out in recent weeks was just about the Democrats shifting blame for their own failures, their loss in the elections to other people. And then he also said that it wasn't actually so important where the hackers are as the fact that the information that they had leaked was actually had proven to be true. He said no one actually denied the fact that the material released about machinations inside the Democratic Party were true. We'd seen the resignation of the chairperson of the Democratic National Committee as confirmation of that. And then he also took a dig at President Obama. President Obama, as you'll remember, had recently said that he told Putin to cut it out. And Putin said he would never reveal the details of a private conversation with another foreign leader.
I was speaking to Nicholas Connolly in Moscow. Now, heads of state from Gabon, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Central African Republic, Congo and Cameroon have been meeting in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, to discuss ways of revamping their economies that are reeling from effects of terrorism and oil prices that have plunged on the world market. Moki Kinzeka in Yaoundé has the details.
2 years ago, the average economic growth in Central African countries stood at about 4%. In 2016, it dropped to 1.6%. As leaders of the six nations met in Yaoundé, they announced that the overall fiscal deficit has worsened from 4.1% of GDP to over 6%. All Central African countries have experienced unprecedented increases in their debt levels. Cameroon's President Paul Biya called on his fellow leaders and International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde for solidarity in handling the crisis.
Our sub-region will not be in an impasse if we remain united and if we transform our political will to adopt appropriate economic measures. I am persuaded that if these measures are taken, we shall again find prosperity. I have no doubt that the informed advice and constant technical support of the International Monetary Fund and other partners in development will be of great help.
The leaders concluded that the countries relied too heavily on petroleum. They agreed that the diversification of the economy and an increased investment in agriculture could promote stronger growth and reduce inequalities. They said the region has an agriculture potential, but less than 12% of the farmland in the six countries is used for agriculture. If the economic hardship persists, the leaders say they may opt for the devaluation of their common currency, the CFA franc.
Moki Kinzeka in Yaoundé.
Of course, as always, we love hearing your opinions on the stories we run. And we'll start with Berlin.
As you heard in the news bulletin, the suspect of the Berlin attack was killed in Italy.
And people are reacting quite strongly to the news. Boniface Stephen from Tanzania says it's good to hear that the person responsible for the Berlin attack has died. After all, he who kills others will also be killed. We also have a comment from Christine Schwartz. And she says, why did he go to Italy? Maybe the Italian security services should be on high alert there. Mm-hmm. Kevin Armstrong is asking, why isn't more effort made to capture these people alive so that they can be interrogated?
Yeah, I mean, so many comments have been coming in both on our website and
indeed,
Facebook about the story. And remember, these comments are opinion, views from you, dear listeners. You are listening to DW's Africa Link program with me, Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And I'm Wanjiko Mwaura from the Social Media Desk.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, scientists develop a vaccine for Ebola that killed close to 12,000 people in West Africa.
The vaccine was developed by Merck together with Norwegian and German and Canadian scientific support. This means we have a significant functioning medicine now against Ebola.
We will hear from a blogger in Kenya telling us about his work, and DW Sports commentator Yusuf Bala will be talking about football.
Yes, indeed. Now, scientists have made a major breakthrough in developing a vaccine against Ebola. Final test results confirmed that the experimental Ebola vaccine was highly effective, a major milestone that could help prevent the spread of outbreaks like the one that killed thousands in West Africa. These scientists struggled to develop the vaccine over the years, and this is the first one proven to work. Efforts were ramped up after the infectious disease caused a major outbreak beginning in 2013 in Guinea and spreading to Liberia and Sierra Leone. About 11,300 people died. To discuss more about the vaccine and its effectiveness, I turn to DW's Fabian Schmidt from the Science Desk.
The vaccine was developed by Merck together with Norwegian and German and Canadian scientific support, and it was rolled out in the summer in June, July of 2015 and applied to over 5,000 people at the time. Now, the vaccine has worked very well. None of those people who received the vaccine actually got an Ebola infection of the 5,000 people. There were roughly 15,000 who did not receive the vaccine. It's a kind of control group, and 23 out of those did get an Ebola infection. But the problem at the time, I remember, was that one couldn't clearly define a control group. So basically, why it took so long for the results to be published, 2 years, is because they really had to do a thorough data analysis to estimate what it means. Because at the time, the rule was you would give the vaccine to everybody whom you knew was in contact with infected people, and you wouldn't deliberately leave anybody out. I think that's one of the reasons why the scientific data to substantiate the efficiency of the vaccine was so difficult.
Exactly. This is where I wanted to bring you the effectiveness of this vaccine and the time when it was applied. Really, it raises questions, isn't it?
Yes. The point is that already when they started applying the vaccine, they expected that the efficiency of the vaccine would almost be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But they, under normal circumstances, in a medical trial, you would do a phase one in which you check that the vaccine is not doing any harm by itself. So you would apply it to healthy people. In phase two, you would then have a bigger group. Only in phase three would you apply it to a large group of more than 1,000 or 2,000 people to see if it actually is effective. And you would have a control group that does not receive the vaccine. You would have a normal group that does receive the vaccine. Now, in the case of Ebola, you couldn't do it. First, Ebola was already on the way out. There weren't that many cases anymore in the summer of 2015. But the second point is you had a real problem because Ebola is so very dangerous. You wouldn't define a control group and say, okay, we deliberately don't give it to you. So you could only afterwards say we have identified so and so many people, thousands of people who didn't get the vaccine, not deliberately, but probably accidentally, and who were exposed to some people who had Ebola in the family or somewhere else. And then in the end, you could do a data analysis and say, okay, here are the people whom we did give the vaccine to. There were some who didn't get the vaccine for whatever reasons, but not deliberately.
Mm.
And then you could do a comparison and find out the vaccine is actually working.
And can we now say this is a scientific breakthrough?
Mm. I think we can say so, that this means we have a significant functioning medicine now against Ebola.
Fabian Schmidt from the Science Desk.
Blog report.
Now it's time for this week's blog report, where we are speaking to leading social media personalities. A little earlier, I spoke to Moses Kilolo, the managing editor of Jalada Africa, a writer's collective which started after a writing workshop in Nairobi in 2013. Now, Jalada Africa publishes African authors exclusively online. They publish stories that tackle various themes, including sex, school, and futuristic narratives. In their recent projects, they focused on languages and published stories in African local languages, as well as translating Ngugi wa Thiong'o's short story, The Upright Revolution, into 40 African languages. I had a chat with Moses about Jalada Africa.
When we started, we had writers from Kenya, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Uganda, and South Africa. But now we have writers from different other countries across the continent.
As an online, exclusively online publisher, what are some of the challenges that you have faced?
The biggest challenge, of course, is at present, there is no money coming in from the work that we produce. Another challenge, which is a good challenge, we've begun to receive so much, you know, material, right? In the last 2 years, we've established our own way of working, and which is very open and which is very inclusive of writers, and which we ensure that we give priority to the work. And this has drawn a lot of attention, and therefore we have a lot of material that we get, even for projects that we're not doing, and we see that these are good things, you know, that are being sent to us, and we have to figure out how to kind of help even people who are, you know, sending that kind of material.
So, do you only publish up and coming writers, or do you have other people that you publish?
We publish all kinds of writers, you know, very young writers. The youngest we've published is 12 years old. And we've published professors, you know, we've published just across the board. When we receive the work, what is important for us is the material. And we handle all material equally, and we ensure that our goal is to make sure that when it's published, it's in its best possible form.
Is it possible to make a living as a writer in Africa?
Depends on where you're living and what kind of work you're writing. There are people who write books, and these books become very successful. There's, you know, a change that's happening. You see writers who are working from the continent receiving accolades everywhere.
Do you think with the internet there is a revolution in preserving African local languages?
Yes, I think so. And actually, our language issue and our translation issue have become the most read and the most shared of all the work that we've done. And this success is important because it shows that people are interested.
How many languages are published on your website, African languages?
So the translation issue is published in 55 languages. But the African languages themselves are 40. Yeah.
And which other medium do you use other than text?
Actually, that's a good question, because one of the things that we are very much exploring is the idea of podcasts or reading out the stories. We have so many people who are interested in their mother tongues, but because for a long time they have not interacted with them, they can understand, but it's so hard to read because it's the first time they're coming across the language in textual format.
Thanks, Moses, for speaking to us from Nairobi. And if you want to join in on the discussion on the topic, go to our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Time now to talk about football. For months now, DW Swahili and Hausa services have been broadcasting live Bundesliga matches to their wider audiences in East and West Africa. One of the commentators in the Hausa language, Yusuf Bala, joined me in the studio a short while ago to discuss how challenging his new task of commentating live soccer is.
Based on the information we are receiving from our listeners, or I can say our audience, it's a very positive development. You know how our people used to like football, and more especially people in the rural areas. You know, a lot of people, they don't have access to TV. Once they have their radio, even if you are working or you have your cattle, you are in the bush, still you have your radio, you can listen to Bundesliga. So whenever we are doing it, they are also part of it. Some of them, they are listening to the live commentary, and at the same time, they are also responding to what we are seeing.
Now, on a personal note, how exciting is it for you to commentate a live Bundesliga match? I assume, or I can imagine, you never thought that one day you would broadcast.
Yes, for me, I find it very interesting, and I find it life challenging, because before I don't have much interest in sport issues, but coming to Deutsche Welle, and I find it very interesting commenting on Bundesliga, because a lot of people know about Premier League, La Liga, and some other league from different part of the continent. But Bundesliga, more especially in our area, is not so popular. But with the Hausa service coming to broadcast live commentary, we now have more listeners. Like, I can even give you one example. I have a I used to broadcast in to the outside world right from Nigeria, because I am in one external organization. But coming to Deutsche Welle, I also used to broadcast. But starting the Bundesliga, a lot of even my family members who used not to respond to my radio activities or my news or whatever I am doing on air. But starting the Bundesliga, they started responding. Ah, yesterday
I had you. So, they are following you now.
They are following me now.
That's
so
interesting.
They find it very interesting. Me too, I find it very interesting, because more listeners, more people like our what we are doing in our department, more especially with regard to this football commentary.
Yusuf Obala, DW's sports commentator from the Hausa service. And since it's almost Christmas Eve, we wanted to find out how people around Africa celebrate Christmas. We decided to ask our colleagues from Ethiopia, Kenya, and Nigeria what their Christmas looks like back home.
Well, we celebrate Christmas back home in Ethiopia not on 24th of December, instead on January 7th. Because, you know, many of Ethiopian are Orthodox Christians. We go to the church, we pray, we sing and song, and then back from the church, we eat and drink.
Well, in Kenya, Christmas is all about merrymaking. It's a time for family and friends as well. We go to attend Christmas Mass, and after that, it's all about eating, drinking, and dancing.
I'm a Muslim, but I celebrate Christmas with my friends. We usually stay in their places, eat, we wine and dine, and then we go to parks and other places for relaxation. We visit friends.
Those are some of our colleagues from the departments of Hausa, Kenya, Nigeria. Yeah, and of course, with me and the studios, my colleague Wanjiku Mora. Tell me about your Christmas tradition.
Christmas for us is having new clothes on Christmas Day and cooking lots of incredible food and cooking together. It's a time for family back home.
Uh-huh.
And what about you? How is Christmas?
First of all, it's church, to go to church on the 24th. That's the service, you know, that's very important. And of course, just like you had our colleagues, myself, my Christmas, I expected new clothes.
Yes.
New shoes, new everything. And of course, the lunch was always magnificent. Lots of chicken, rice, matoke, name it. And in the afternoon, cinema, you know, to spice up the cake.
Mm-hmm. And you actually remind me that it's one of the few times in the year when we were allowed to have sodas on Christmas.
Pepsi and Mirinda. Don't forget also to invite neighbors. We had neighbors from all faith, especially the Muslim.
Because they always invited us when it was Eid.
Definitely. Now, away from Christmas, what do we have, you know, from our Facebook page and social media?
Well, we do have the video that we posted yesterday on the Migration Dilemma series that we have been running.
And this one, what was it about in particular?
The last video that I will read a comment from is about the Gambian youth who have been leaving the country in droves, but the Youth Council has been teaching them opportunities that exist in Gambia and giving them reason to stay in Gambia. And Ruby Raut shared this on the comment section. This year when I went to Gambia, the taxi driver we had has a nephew who reached Italy by boat, risking his life. We were all glad that at least he made it, but it's horrible to hear and see to what extent people risk their lives for better future.
I mean, you can still watch that video on Facebook and leave us your thoughts, and comments. What else do you have very briefly, Wanjiku?
We also asked the same question about Christmas tradition, and Nana Akwasi says, in Ghana, our tradition is throwing knockouts and having fun with all people.
Yeah,
I mean, well, that's all we have for today. But before we go for a well-deserved weekend, our top story was opposition politicians in the DRC agree in principle to a deal under which President Joseph Kabila leaves office by the end of 2017, paving way for the elections in April 2018. For more news, visit our website, dw.com/Africa.
And visit also our Facebook page, DW Africa.
And on behalf of the entire production team with me and the studios, Merry Christmas to you all.